Our speaker today is Arshad Mohammed Ismail, who at the moment is a visiting fellow in Islamic finance at the Oxford Center for Islamic Studies. But when he is not here doing work as a visiting fellow, he's the executive vice president and head of corporate and investment banking at Maybank Islamic in Malaysia. And he's going to talk to us today about a topic that we've heard addressed here in the seminar before, but possibly from a different perspective, from the banking sector itself, looking at the development of Islamic finance in Malaysia, facts, issues, and potential. So please join me in welcoming Arshad Ismail.
Matt, thank you very much. If it's all right with all of you, I'll sit. I'm not an academician. I have a day job as a banker, so I'm not used to lecturing. So I'd rather have a discussion. Please feel free to stop me at any time during my presentation. It's more comfortable to address issues and questions as we go along. I also have to state that I'm not a Sharia scholar because I'll be spending a bit of time talking about Sharia principles, because Islamic banking and finance as an industry is regulated by Islamic law and Sharia principles. And we have experts who help bankers understand what the requirements of Islamic law is. So I have to make it clear, I'm not a Sharia scholar, but I'll be giving an overview of general Sharia principles before jumping into a discussion on the development of Islamic finance in Malaysia itself. I was telling Matt earlier as we were walking to this room that bankers tend to have limited intellectual capabilities. I hope that is not too obvious today. Before I start, could I ask, I know my colleague Professor Sadia has a good understanding of Islamic finance, but is there anyone else in this room who is familiar to some extent with the industry? Very good. So that makes me a bit more nervous. As I said earlier, Islamic finance is an industry that is subject to Islamic law or Sharia. And unlike other faiths, Islam is basically seen as a way of life. And when Islamic scholars argue or state that Islam is a way of life, it basically encompasses every aspect of a Muslim's life. And this includes economic activities and, by extension, banking and finance. So that's basically the foundation from which we start. And it basically covers every aspect of a Muslim's life. It relates to his faith. It relates to his life, the intellect, posterity, and property. And what exactly is the Sharia, or what are the features of Islamic law? And these are basically the features or characteristics of Islamic law that scholars often speak about. It's of divine origin. It is realistic and contemporary. It is universal. It's balanced in the sense that Islamic law relates to both the current world as well as the hereafter. And it is complete. So these are the characteristics of Sharia or Islamic law as we know it. What are the sources of Islamic law? Now, it's obvious that the Holy Quran is a very important source of Islamic law. Now, in addition to the Holy Quran, we also have the Sunnah, the sayings, deeds, and approvals of the Holy Prophet. And this is another major source of Islamic law. And in Islamic finance, this becomes an important source because many practices in Islamic banking and finance today don't have direct injunctions in the Quran itself. So we have to look at other sources to derive rules and regulations that apply to Islamic banking and finance. So these are commonly referred to as the primary sources of Islamic law, the Holy Quran and the Sunnah. Now, there is a whole body of knowledge known as the sciences of the Hadith or Ulumul Hadith, which relates to how rulings are derived from Sunnah or Hadith. And that's a very complex area of study, which I'm also not an expert in. Now, there are secondary sources of Islamic law, and I'll just run through these secondary sources very quickly. We have ijma, which is commonly described as universal consensus of opinion of scholars of the Muslim community as a whole in a particular period of time. Now, modern day Islamic scholars argue that ijma as a source of law today is no longer relevant simply because it requires the unanimous consensus of all scholars in a particular area. So during the period immediately after the Prophet's demise, it was still possible to actually secure the consensus of opinion among scholars of a particular area. But in the modern day context, it is no longer possible, and therefore modern day Islamic scholars argue that this as a source of Islamic law today is no longer applicable. Having said that, they still refer to rulings that were extracted or derived through this process during the period immediately after the Prophet's demise. We have qiyas as another source of law. Qiyas is loosely translated as analogy, where scholars find a ruling in the primary sources that relates to a particular event or a particular act, and by analogy, extend that ruling to a modern day situation or contract or event. And qiyas in banking and finance, in Islamic banking and finance, has become quite an important method of deriving rules and regulations. As you would expect, the Quran and the Sunnah don't have very many provisions that relate to modern day Islamic banking practices. So qiyas becomes an important method of deriving laws, regulations that apply to modern day practices. Moving on, we have maslaha, which is basically a concept that takes into account public interest when developing laws and regulations. Urf, or common practice, is also a source of law. So if something is common in a particular society, and as long as that practice does not go against the basic principles of the religion as stated in the Quran or the Sunnah, such practices could take on the force of law if the scholars decide that, as I said earlier, it does not contravene the basic principles of Sharia, and that it would be for the benefit of society to codify that particular practice into something that looks more like a regulation or law. And finally, we also have the process of blocking the means that could lead to an act that would otherwise go against the principles of Sharia. Now, a very simple example scholars often use to explain this concept is the distribution of alcoholic beverages. In Islam, alcohol is prohibited, and by extension, the distribution of alcoholic beverages is also unacceptable from a Sharia perspective. So that's a very simple example, and this is often used again in Islamic banking and finance to derive rules and regulations. Any questions before we move on? Good. It could mean one of two things. Either I'm making everything very clear, or you have no idea what I'm saying. Hopefully it's the former. Now, this basically puts into perspective what I started off by saying. What I started off by saying just now was Islam is a way of life. It applies to every aspect of a Muslim's life. So you have Aqidah, you have Fiqh, and Akhlaq. Aqidah, basically, that box over there relates to a Muslim's faith and belief. You have Fiqh, which relates to his practices and activities, and moralities and ethics. So Islamic banking and finance obviously falls under this branch. Now, this branch is further divided into worship and muamalat, which is basically commercial activities. And then you come down, you have economic activities, political activities, and social activities. Islamic banking and finance sits here. Now, the economic activities also encompass non-profitable activities such as zakat and wakaf. You might know that zakat is a form of religious tax and wakaf is a form of religious endowment. So the general argument is that together the profitable activities and the non-profitable activities make up the Islamic economic foundation or way of approaching how capital is to be distributed. As I said earlier, we have many different branches under the Sharia. Now, when we speak of faith-related matters, for example, how a Muslim conducts or performs his prayer, the general understanding is that it is prescriptive, whereby the Muslim prays in a manner that has been prescribed by the Prophet and by the sort of various schools of Islamic thought that have become well regarded and are followed in the area of Islamic jurisprudence. However, when it comes to economic activities, the general understanding is that of ibaha or permissibility. As long as something is not specifically prohibited, it is generally permissible. So that is a line of argument adopted by many scholars when we discuss Islamic banking products and services. So just to repeat myself, when it comes to faith-related matters, the rulings are prescriptive in the sense that a Muslim is expected to perform his prayer, for example, in the manner prescribed. But when it comes to economic activities, there generally is no such prescription. The doctrine of permissibility states that as long as something is not specifically prohibited, it is generally permissible. And we will see later what are the various factors or issues that are specifically prohibited under Islamic law and how these prohibitions are then incorporated into Islamic banking practices and products. Now, these are, in summary, I apologize for the small font, but just focus on the yellow boxes. In summary, these are the four main areas that scholars and Islamic bankers focus on when determining what is permissible, what is acceptable within the context of Islamic banking and finance. Now, I think it's obvious to everybody that riba or interest is prohibited from an Islamic law perspective. And this is pretty much the cornerstone of Islamic banking and finance. The lending of money in exchange for a rate of return is basically considered to be prohibited because it leads to riba or the charging of interest. Now, some people argue that interest is riba, but riba actually is a lot more than just interest. However, I think it's sufficient for me to say that the interest that we have in modern day banking is one form of riba. There are other forms of riba, but a banking interest is one form of riba, and that is generally regarded as being prohibited from an Islamic law perspective. Now, gharar or uncertainty, or contracts that are of an uncertain nature, are also prohibited. And one example I can think of is a forward contract. Now, in banking, forward contracts are very common. Basically, you enter into an agreement to buy or sell a product in the future. That's very, very common in the conventional banking space. But from an Islamic law perspective, that would be viewed as an uncertain contract because the person purporting to sell the product does not own that product at the time the contract is entered into, and therefore it would fail for uncertainty. And then you have the prohibition against contracts that have elements of speculation or gambling. Now, an example here would be short selling, if you're familiar with the concept of short selling. Now, again, the subprime crisis basically was, founded on this, not to say founded, but there was a lot of speculation going on where bankers repackaged subprime loans, and then you had people on the other side betting against those loans. People were shorting these bonds, and basically lots of speculation going on. So those who bet against the subprime loans made a lot of money, but those who actually bought into this whole story that was the subprime mortgage fiasco lost a lot of money. Now, Islamic banks by default were not involved in those transactions because those transactions did not satisfy certain Sharia requirements. So these transactions were of a speculative nature, and there was also the general prohibition against buying and selling of debt. So for these reasons, all Islamic banks were insulated from that crisis. Not so much because Islamic banks were a lot smarter than the Wall Street banks, but simply because the Sharia scholars would have said to these Islamic banks that these contracts were of a speculative nature, and therefore we, the Sharia scholars, cannot give you approval to participate in these transactions. And then, of course, there are prohibitions against entering into contracts that involve prohibited commodities. Now, the obvious commodities that are prohibited would be alcohol, tobacco, pork, a few examples. But I also have to highlight that trading in gold and silver, although common in the conventional banking space, would not be so straightforward in the Islamic banking space, because gold and silver, from a Sharia perspective, are seen as mediums of exchange. And when a particular commodity is viewed as a medium of exchange, there are certain rules that relate to the sale and the purchase of these commodities. One example would be the sale of gold cannot be on deferred payment terms. Because if the sale of gold is on deferred payment terms, then an element of riba would be present, and it would not be acceptable from a Sharia perspective. So I see many of you are familiar with these concepts, so I don't need to go into greater detail. Islamic banks in general are permitted to engage in transactions with companies in most industries, except these few industries. And this is a very short list because, as I said earlier, in commercial transactions, the general principle is you can do anything and everything as long as it is not specifically prohibited. That's why this list is a very short list. So it's pretty obvious that Islamic banks cannot fund banks, conventional banks. Islamic banks cannot give financing facilities to companies that are involved in gambling activities or the gaming sector, the sale of non-halal products, conventional insurance, entertainment, stockbroking, or share trading in securities not approved by the Sharia. Now, one industry that is not on this list, but an industry that is nonetheless prohibited, is the arms and weapons industry. So this is also an industry that Sharia scholars do not permit Islamic banks to have any dealings with. So where... Yes, please, Kevin.
So I wonder how this list is expanding and contracting.
Well, the list has remained very short. In fact, to the best of my knowledge, this list has been like this for the past 30, 40 years. As I said, the general principle is one of permissibility. As long as it is not specifically prohibited, you are permitted to enter into commercial transactions with whomsoever you decide to enter into. But you have to avoid the activities that are specifically or clearly prohibited under the Sharia.
Have you seen your Sharia boards, you know, thinking in different ways? The theology has moved forward on issues like the environment, on issues like tobacco and certain medical processes.
Tobacco has always been on this list from the early days. The environment is an interesting topic. Islamic banks have not had to consider the environment, at least until now. Islamic banks have not had to consider the environment when deciding or reviewing applications for financing. I know for a fact that in Malaysia, the central bank is now looking into ESG principles. And the question is whether ESG principles should be part of Sharia principles, in Malaysia at least. So the Central Bank of Malaysia, of course, would not have the authority to impose its views on other jurisdictions. But at least within Malaysia, talk has started. And I remember attending a few sessions last year. Our basically thinking was ESG principles should sit outside the general body of Sharia principles. So you could have a company that is fully Sharia compliant, but it does not comply with ESG principles. And then the other school of thought, of course, is that ESG principles should sit within the general body of Sharia principles, and that if a company fails any of the ESG criteria, it would then be declared a non-Sharia compliant company. No decision has been made. I guess Islamic banking over the last 30 years has had to resolve more basic and fundamental issues. Now that these basic and fundamental issues, by and large, have been sorted out, I think the regulators are now moving on to the next phase of the development of the industry. Yes.
Thank you.
Okay.
Can I ask just related to this? the prohibition on manufacture or sale of non-halal products applies to those products that where halal sort of production regulation is, is applied to. The reason why I'm asking this is we had a presenter last year who was talking about the proliferation of halal certification.
Yes.
And about halal certification on products that don't seem to have any reason to be halal certified. So for example, you know, would the manufacture or sale of water that is not halal certified be prohibited if there happen to be halal certified waters that are being sold? Does that make sense?
Yes, it makes sense. Valid question. The Sharia scholars I've had the privilege of working with have not ever raised such an issue.
Hmm.
So you might have commercially minded individuals or companies promoting that concept, but I've not had Sharia scholars actually saying to us bankers that you should only fund companies that sell halal certified water, because the argument is water.
Right.
But if a particular product is obviously unacceptable from a Sharia perspective, then it would not be permissible.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thanks.
So contrary to popular belief, the Sharia scholars who advise banks are actually quite commercial minded. Many, of course, have degrees in fiqh or Islamic law, but many also have degrees in economics or even finance. And these are the scholars who then become the so-called rock star scholars simply because they understand what bankers need to do or are trying to do. And it's very easy for bankers to actually have discussions with them. And once upon a time in Malaysia, of course, I can talk about other jurisdictions as well, but in the 80s, when Islamic banking was first introduced in Malaysia, we had no more than 6 scholars who, you know, were members of almost all the Sharia committees in the country. And you can imagine how popular and busy these scholars must have been. I can still name them, the 5 or 6 scholars. Ten or 15 years after Islamic banking was first introduced, the central bank decided that this was not a very healthy state of affairs, and it imposed almost overnight a restriction on the number of Sharia committees each scholar is allowed to serve on. So from serving on 15 to 20 committees yesterday, today, that same scholar can only serve on the Sharia committee of one bank and one insurance company. What happened? It forced banks to identify other scholars. And of course, at that time, as bankers, we were quite unhappy because these new scholars were nowhere near as knowledgeable about general banking practices as these rock star scholars. But the central bank was right. So that was 10 years ago. So today, we have so many more scholars who are knowledgeable in all the relevant areas in Islamic banking and finance. So obviously, they have to be knowledgeable in fiqh, in Sharia. But over time, they have become knowledgeable on banking practices, on economic issues, and so on. So this is the kind of pool of scholars that we need to see in order for the industry to be able to develop efficiently. Now, if you look at the Middle East, you will have the same problem Malaysia had some years ago. Of course, there are many scholars in the Middle East, but all the major banks still go to the same 5 to 6 scholars. And these scholars, I think it was EY or Deloitte that conducted a study some years ago. And on the average, these 5 or 6 scholars at that time, and I think even today, sit on 70 to 80 Sharia committees. Now, these scholars know their subject matter, no doubt about it. But the concern, of course, is that if they have to serve on 60 to 70 Sharia or 80 Sharia committees, how much time can they, you know, devote to each committee? How much time can they devote to understanding issues that are presented to them? But that's the state of affairs in the Middle East. But when I say the Middle East, we are talking about a collection of jurisdictions. So you cannot impose the kind of regulations the Malaysian Central Bank imposed in Malaysia, because it's not one jurisdiction in the Middle East. But that's the current state of affairs as far as Sharia scholars is concerned in the Middle East. So before I move on, the last paragraph there, I think, is a good summary of the main difference between conventional banking and Islamic banking. Conventional banking is about lending and borrowing. Now, lending and borrowing in the ordinary sense of the word, as we know it today, would not be acceptable from a Sharia perspective because of the interest element. So in Islamic banking and finance, we have sale contracts, purchase contracts, lease, construction, and so on. And we will see later how these trading principles or concepts are executed in what is essentially a banking environment. Have I lost everybody? Or any questions before I move on to the next part of the presentation? Yes, please.
Thinking about uncertainty and like ways you can define it, like, aren't you, when you say invest in a company, aren't you betting on a profitable outcome, which is uncertain? And also, isn't investing in a company lending it money? And also, how do you make money?
Okay. That's a good question. Otherwise, I won't have a day job.
Is it like fixed rate?
Okay. Well, let me give you the jurisprudential answer. From a Sharia perspective, money is a medium of exchange. Now, what does that lead us to? It means we cannot use money to make more money. So that's the general argument. So in a conventional lending relationship, the bank, which has money, lends money to a customer who needs money, and the customer pays interest over a period of 10 years or so, and after 10 years the customer pays the principal back, or the principal is paid progressively. So that is essentially an arrangement where the bank uses money to make more money. So from a pure Sharia perspective, this arrangement is not acceptable because of the interest element, but more importantly, because money is seen as a medium of exchange and you cannot use money to make more money. So how then are commercial transactions supposed to be conducted from a Sharia perspective? There is an element of risk and reward. So if you go back to the original sources of Islamic jurisprudence relating to commercial transactions, the argument that is put forward is that in order for the owner of capital to earn from the capital he or she owns, he or she has to participate not just in the reward but also in the risk. Now, what does that mean from a practical perspective? The contracts that are therefore promoted as being Sharia compliant are contracts of partnership in a very loose sense. And the Arabic concepts that are often put forward as reflecting this partnership arrangement are mudarabah and musharaka. These are, you know, two very common contracts. Now, what is mudarabah? It's basically an arrangement whereby one party provides the capital, the other party is the entrepreneur, or the party that provides the expertise to manage and work that capital, and the profits generated by that venture would be shared in a pre-agreed ratio between the bank or the owner of the capital and the entrepreneur who works that capital. And then musharaka is just a variation of that. The only difference is in a musharaka contract, which is also a partnership contract, both parties contribute capital. One could contribute cash, the other could contribute land, and there is an understanding between them that one of them or a third party would then manage that capital, and so on. So if that venture experiences losses, then those losses have to be shared between the two partners. So there is no sort of guarantee that the owner of capital will make money regardless of what happens to the underlying project. What was the second part of the question?
Apart from how you make money.
Yes.
Just in general about uncertainty, like making a profit relies on uncertainty, right?
Okay. It's all right to make money if you participate in the risk of the underlying project.
Oh, and also how investing is different from lending. Like, if lending is not allowed, surely investing in a company, buying its shares that it like releases, is lending it money.
Okay. Then, to answer that question, we need to go back to the prohibition against riba. So the prohibition against riba is basically that you cannot lend money and expect more money to be returned to you. So that, in very simple terms, is what the prohibition is all about. And the other concept I shared with you earlier is that in commercial contracts, we go with the principle of permissibility. As long as it is not specifically prohibited, it is acceptable. So an investment contract does not contravene any of the established principles that we have to avoid in order for a contract to be Sharia compliant. So in this particular arrangement, we just have to check whether it contravenes any of the three or four elements I highlighted earlier. Is there an element of riba? No, because there is no lending arrangement. You have a valid question in relation to uncertainty, but again, uncertainty is not open-ended. Right? It's not every type of uncertainty that would be prohibited. In the investment relationship, you are participating in the risk as well as the reward. So when you invest in a company, you stand to gain if the company does well, but you stand to lose if the company does not do well. So it's an investment arrangement or relationship, and that is not specifically prohibited. So going back to your point on uncertainty, the uncertainty that is prohibited is not open-ended, otherwise we cannot do anything and everything. But there are certain elements that have to be present in order for uncertainty to be prohibited from a Sharia perspective, if that makes sense. Was there another part to the question? Okay, thank you for that. So, having given a bit of background to what Islamic banking and finance is constructed upon, and it is basically constructed upon Sharia principles, we now come to Islamic finance as it is practiced in Malaysia. Now, this is something I shared with my colleagues at the center as well. you would have come across many people arguing against the way Islamic banking is practiced today. And this is a summary of that criticism. Evidently, the Islamic financial movement is attempting to adapt Islamic instruments originally designed for pre-industrial trade and handicrafts to a post-industrial global economy. There is a verse in the Quran that states that, and I'm paraphrasing, riba or interest is prohibited, but trade is permissible. Because during the time of the Prophet, what people were doing was to buy products at a particular price and then sell that same product in the marketplace at a markup or at a higher price. You know, basic trading. You buy at a low price and you sell at a higher price. And some were arguing that this is riba, because essentially what is happening is instead of lending money and getting more money in return, he is buying a product at a lower price, selling it in the market, and making more money as a result of that transaction. And in response to that situation during the time of the Prophet, this particular verse was revealed, and in that verse it is clearly stated that riba is prohibited, however, trade transactions are permitted. So, trade transactions being acceptable from a Sharia perspective have formed the foundation of Islamic banking today. So you won't find lending and borrowing transactions in Islamic banks. What you will find are sale transactions, leasing transactions, and so on and so forth. But of course, when all these transactions are executed within a banking environment, it is quite difficult to run away from the core elements of the banking industry. And we can sort of go into a discussion on that a little later. Now, this is a timeline of the development of Islamic banking in Malaysia. Now, before the first Islamic bank was formally established in Malaysia, and that was in 1983, we had Tabung Haji, or the Pilgrimage Fund Board. It wasn't a bank, it was basically an institution established to help Muslims in Malaysia save for the pilgrimage to Mecca. So, as a Muslim, I could open an account at Tabung Haji, deposit money on a monthly basis. Tabung Haji, of course, would invest the funds in different sectors, in theory, generate good returns, and over time I would have enough money to make that trip to the Holy Land. In 1975, Dubai Islamic Bank was established. And Dubai Islamic Bank is still very much in existence today, doing very well. And IDB, the Islamic Development Bank in Jeddah, was also established in 1975. Now, the IDB is the only AAA rated institution in the Islamic finance sector. But IDB is not really it is not a commercial bank. It is more a developmental bank, like the ADB, the Asian Development Bank, like the African Development Bank, and so on. Now, 1983 is when Islamic banking officially took off in Malaysia. The Islamic Banking Act 1983 was passed, and the first bank under this act was established, Bank Islam Malaysia Berhad. And it was the only Islamic bank in the country. No other bank had the license to offer Islamic banking products and services. And it had a monopoly for a good 10 years. And at that time, Bank Islam was allowed to basically dominate the market, to build a pool of clients without any fear of having to compete with other banks. In 1993, the government decided that Bank Islam, you know, had enough time to establish itself. It then allowed conventional banks, regular banks offering normal banking products, to also offer Islamic banking products and services. In 1993, most banks opened windows. Now, windows are basically departments within the banks, and these departments would develop products and market these products to the general public. Now, what happened over time is that these conventional banks with Islamic windows started becoming a lot bigger than Bank Islam, because the conventional banks, to start with, were a lot bigger than Bank Islam. These banks had many more branches. And when the central bank in 1993 allowed conventional banks to start offering Islamic banking products and services, they were able to leverage on their branch networks, on their sales teams, to build a portfolio of Islamic banking assets that very quickly became so much bigger than Bank Islam's Islamic banking portfolio. To give you an example, I work for Maybank Islamic. So Maybank was a conventional bank. Well, it still is a conventional bank. And Maybank in 1993 started offering Islamic banking products. And today, Maybank's Islamic banking portfolio is the largest Islamic banking portfolio in Asia Pacific. We basically leveraged on the conventional, our parent, to build a business. And over time, the central bank started encouraging these windows to be converted into subsidiaries. And over time, all the windows became subsidiaries of the parent banks, and Maybank Islamic itself became a subsidiary only in 2008. And since then, we have had very encouraging growth. The central bank's objective is to have at least 20 to 25% of the total banking portfolio in Malaysia to be Sharia compliant. So some banks are almost there. Other banks have a long way to go. In the case of Maybank, we are already at 42%, simply because of a very aggressive marketing campaign that we undertook over the last 5 years or so. So we keep going back to the central bank, and we keep saying to them that we have done so well. We basically have put in place your objective way before you expected the industry to reach that benchmark or that level. But I think over the next 5 years or so, the other banks will be able to catch up. But simply because the industry itself has taken on a life of its own, I don't think the banking base views Islamic banking as being deficient in any way. Once upon a time, there was this perception that Islamic banking products were not as competitive as conventional products. And there were good reasons, because number one, when Bank Islam was the only bank offering these products, there was no competition, so there was no incentive for Bank Islam to make their products, you know, as competitive as they could have been. But today, with every bank offering Islamic banking products and services, with the customers having the option of going to various banks or even going back to conventional banks, Islamic banks don't have the luxury of being complacent. So I can safely say that today, Islamic banking products and services are easily as competitive, in some cases even more competitive in some aspects, when compared with conventional banking products and services. we have what is known as a dual banking system. The conventional banks are regulated under an act of parliament. The Islamic banks are regulated under another act of parliament. The current act of parliament, the Islamic Financial Services Act of 2013, as the name suggests, came into force in 2013. And unlike the previous act, this new act imposes more obligations upon the management. It imposes more obligations upon the board of directors to ensure that the operations are Sharia compliant. Now, this is perhaps stating the obvious. Previously, the obligation to ensure that the bank's operations, products, and activities are Sharia compliant was primarily on the Sharia committee. So the bankers, the management would conveniently send everything. Of course, I am generalizing, but everything would be sent to the Sharia committee. The Sharia committee would be expected to review and decide whether the products and services were compliant or otherwise. And the bankers would then go off and offer those products. But under the Islamic Financial Services Act, that luxury has disappeared. The management cannot argue that the committee had signed off on a particular product and therefore they are not to be blamed if subsequently it is discovered that certain principles were not adhered to. So unfortunately, Islamic bankers could find themselves in prison if it is discovered that bankers deliberately either deceived the Sharia scholars or did certain things to secure the approvals without fully disclosing the facts and the issues behind certain products, if that makes any sense. Yeah. Yes, please.
So the Securities Commission in Malaysia has a central Sharia law in itself.
Thank you for the question. So we have the central bank that regulates banking activities, and we have the Securities Commission that regulates the securities business. So the issuance of Islamic bonds, the establishment of funds would all be subject to the review and approval of the Securities Commission. But banking activities and banking products would be subject to review and the approval of the central bank. So the answer to your question is yes. The Securities Commission has its own Sharia committee. So as a bank, if I'm advising a company on the issuance of Islamic bonds, I would have to make a submission to the Securities Commission to secure the approval of the commission before that bond can be issued.
My question is this. So from your point that you said bankers can find them in prison, so this means these two central boards decides what is Islamic, what is in Sharia generally, that the banks have to comply it. And if these two regulators come to the bank and make an audit and it's not Sharia and deliberately made by this design, they can convince them to do more.
Yes. You see, as I said, the Securities Commission has a Sharia committee, so all capital market transactions would be subject to review by this committee, and the Central Bank of Malaysia has its own committee, and the Sharia committee at the Central Bank regulates banking activities and products.
So from your point in the first beginning, you said there is no way in ijma consensus. So these two regulators are making the ijma because they say this is Sharia compliant in Malaysia. So you are making this is ijma by the Malaysian government.
Good point. But my understanding of ijma, as taught to me by my professors, is that it requires the consensus of all scholars in a particular jurisdiction,
yes.
Right? And scholars then go on to say that today it is practically impossible to secure the consensus of opinion of all jurists and scholars in a particular jurisdiction. Right? Now, of course, we can go back and forth, but these two committees agreeing on a particular matter, unfortunately, does not qualify as ijma, based on the rules established by the Islamic scholars.
So, sorry for extending.
Yeah.
If they are go to the court and if they committed, so they have to find another scholar and they will say this is in Sharia, isn't this the case?
Good question.
How will they defend themselves in the court? They will say this is in Sharia. We thought that was in Sharia, and that they will find a scholar, and these regulators, scholars will say no. So,
yeah.
Okay. Now, see, in the case of a capital market transaction, we don't have that danger simply because of the process, right? So when we advise company ABC on the structuring of Islamic bonds, we have to secure the approval of our Sharia committee. So I take it to the Maybank Sharia committee, I present the paper, the committee basically will either approve it or it will ask me to make amendments to the structure. Once I have the approval of the Maybank committee, I have to make a submission to the Securities Commission. The Securities Commission capital markets team will then process the application, and they will then submit that application to the Securities Commission Sharia committee. And if the Securities Commission team decides that there are contentious issues in our submission, they will highlight it to the Securities Commission Sharia committee. And if the committee at the commission decides that it's acceptable or unacceptable, the commission team will then advise us. We can advise the company to issue the bonds only and only if the Securities Commission has given its approval. And the Securities Commission, in addition to checking on all other matters, will also ensure that from a Sharia perspective, the structure, the transaction are all acceptable. Right? So the process is actually quite robust. So we cannot issue anything until the Securities Commission gives us the approval, and the Securities Commission will not give us its approval until its committee, the central committee, clears it.
How long does it take, an average, how long time?
According to the established process, 3 weeks. Having said that, the team at the Securities Commission can always come back to us with queries. And if they come back to us with queries, then of course we have to address these queries, and then they have a further 3 weeks to sort everything out. Now, if the issue is particularly complex, they will invite us to actually present to the committee at the Securities Commission. If it's straightforward, then they will handle it on their own. Yes?
Can you walk us through the process for the Bank of Barra then? Is that where you might have more issues, where issues of compliance arise after the fact, or are there safeguards similarly?
Okay. Thank you for that question. I think the best way to answer your question is to highlight a few cases that were actually referred to court. Now, how does the Bank Negara process work? The Bank Negara Sharia Committee is established under IFSA, the Islamic Finance Services Act. So that is the committee that has the authority to declare what is acceptable and what is not acceptable. So the Sharia committees at each of the banks needs to be aware of the rulings issued by the central committee. So the committees at the banks cannot issue a ruling that goes against the rulings issued by the central committee. Now, if a committee at a particular bank cannot resolve a particular issue, then that committee can refer that dispute or that query to the central bank committee. But typically, we wouldn't need to do that because, for example, in our case, the chairman of our committee also sits on the Bank Negara committee, and he also sits on the Securities Commission committee, right? So we are able to, you know, derive a lot of comfort from this fact. Now, after the event, if a matter is referred to court. Previously, before IFSA, the court had full authority, or the judge had full authority, to decide what is acceptable or unacceptable from a Sharia perspective, because the argument was Islamic law is part of the law of the land. So the judge, notwithstanding the fact that he is civil law or common law judge, had the authority vested in him to make pronouncements on Sharia related matters, because there was no other avenue for him or her to resolve that question. But under IFSA, the Islamic Financial Services Act, there is a process whereby the courts can refer Sharia related issues to the committee at the central bank, right? And the Act also states that a decision given by the committee at the central bank shall be final and binding on the court. So the judge does not have the liberty of disagreeing with a ruling given by the committee at the central bank. Was that your question? Yeah. I think your colleague had a question.
Yeah, I was also curious, so does this happen for every bond issue, or is it for a particular type of bond? How, it seems like a very cumbersome system for if it needs to be done for every single bond issue.
It's a good point. It applies to every bond issue in Malaysia. If you're familiar with the dollar bond market, we don't have to get any approval. If we offer in the Regulation S market, you just have to engage a good bank to advise you, and the bank basically knows what the market would accept and what the market would not accept. So it's more a self-regulated industry, the Regulation S bond market, and you don't need to secure any approvals. The only approvals you need to secure would be to market your bonds in specific jurisdictions. For example, in the case of Bahrain, you just have to notify the central bank. It's the same in the UAE. You have to notify the central bank. In the UK, you don't have to notify. But in Malaysia, you still have to get the approval to market your bonds, even if it's a dollar bond. But if it's a ringgit local currency bond or Islamic bond transaction, you have to go through the full process of submitting the paperwork and waiting for the approval of the commission before issuing the bonds.
Even if it's not a Sharia compliant bond?
Yeah, the Securities Commission regulates regular bonds and Islamic bonds. But over the years, the Securities Commission, to be fair to the commission, has made it easier to issue, because if a market is going to be competitive, you have to make it as easy as possible for companies to be able to raise funding. But anyway, the Securities Commission has its own line of thinking. Ultimately, the Commission wants to protect the interests of the individual, of the institutional investors. counter argument is if you are an institutional investor, you don't need much protection. You're expected to know what these products are all about. But then the subprime crisis has taught us that institutional investors can be pretty stupid, right? Was that the question?
Yes, that
yeah.
was the question.
All right. Yes. Yeah.
So there's been a lot of talk about ring fencing riskier assets in regulation. So just wondering, for Islamic banking, you move from window to your own subsidiary, so now you hold your own regulatory capital.
Yes.
You still share like the same branches, the same people, perhaps the same system for some as well. So moving forward, do you see it being more segmented between Islamic and conventional?
Okay. At the moment, there is no commingling of funds because we are an independent entity. When I say we, I'm talking about any Islamic bank in Malaysia. When these Islamic banks were windows, then of course the funds were basically part and parcel of the larger pool of banking funds. Bankers often say money is fungible. You can't really state that this is Muslim money and this is non-Muslim money. But when you have a separate legal entity, then it's a lot easier to keep the funds separate. There is no objection to the sharing of branches. Once upon a time, there was some pressure on Islamic banks to operate independently. Banks pushed back because bankers are capitalists. It's not efficient to establish a separate branch network. And the regulators saw the logic in that, and as of now, there is no pressure on banks to actually operate independently. So that's as far as branch networks are concerned. We, of course, rely on our colleagues at the conventional bank to market our products because we have only so many executives. Thank you very much. And that can be a problem because the colleagues sitting on the other side of the fence might not be as familiar with Islamic banking principles and products as we would like them to be. But of course, there is ongoing training, but sometimes things fall through the cracks and we do end up having audit findings as a result of certain processes not being Sharia compliant. Now, what is the future? I don't want to speculate, but I'll give you the example of Qatar. A few years ago, practically overnight, the central bank decided that conventional banks would no longer be permitted to own Islamic banks. And it became a major issue because at that time, if I remember correctly, conventional banks were offering Islamic products and services through departments or windows. And then, of course, there were other banks that had subsidiaries, but the Qatar Central Bank took the very drastic step of stating or, making it unlawful for Islamic banks to be even owned by conventional banks. So HSBC, I was working for HSBC at that time, was one of those banks we only had a window, but there were other banks with subsidiaries, and we actually had to sell our Islamic portfolio to one of the other local banks. Now in Malaysia, I think in the next 5 to 10 years, we will probably go down the same route because it makes no sense for Malaysia to keep on shouting that it's a leader in Islamic finance when many of the Islamic banks don't really operate independently. They basically leverage on the parent banks that are all conventional banks. When this will happen, I don't know, but my view is it should happen because it's only when Islamic banks are totally independent of conventional banks would we see the more conservative views being executed and implemented within the banking scenario. At the moment, unfortunately, we are still subject to many of the views of conventional risk managers and conventional bankers by virtue of the fact that we are owned by a conventional bank. So when that will happen, I don't know. It could be 5 years or 10 years, but I think it will happen. It's just a matter of time. Yeah.
I think this idea of the problem of the fungibility of money is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And how far removed does a sort of a non-Sharia compliant transaction have to be from the compliant transaction before it becomes unacceptable? And to give you an example, I'm helping run a startup that does it's an online marketplace for Sharia compliant financing for small businesses. And we're wondering, for example, if someone were to take out a loan, an interest-bearing loan, and then lend that money through our website to businesses, of course the website, the transaction on our website would be compliant. But would that be unacceptable by virtue of how that money was made available? This is something that we're struggling with, and we don't know the answer.
Okay. It depends on how conservative your scholar wants to be. No, that's
yeah,
a fact.
Sure.
Because some scholars can adopt a more conservative approach and advise you that the source of the money has to be Sharia compliant. But to date, based on all the scholars we have had the opportunity to seek advice from, that example would not be a problem, right? So to, you know, put things into perspective, I can basically go to Barclays, get $1 million loan, and I can then enter into a Sharia compliant arrangement with Matt, and this arrangement would remain Sharia compliant, notwithstanding the fact that the source of my funding is not Sharia compliant. And this is the view of the majority of scholars in Islamic finance today.
Good.
Yeah. Because otherwise I won't be able to operate, because
exactly.
I am
exactly. Yeah.
a subsidiary of a conventional bank. My capital is from my parent bank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, it makes sense. It, by the same token, how could you account for where all of your depositors got their money? And it,
yes.
it seems like it becomes impossible.
Right.
But sorry, to follow on from that then, would you potentially see opinion on that changing were Islamic financial sectors within particular countries to become more independent along the Qatar lines, along what you were suggesting that where Malaysia might go? I mean, you know, if you increasingly had Islamic financial sectors that were independent, that were not reliant on conventional parent bank funding, couldn't you then see the regulations tightening up in terms of where the source money comes from? Or is that unlikely to happen in that way?
Well, I think the furthest we'll go is to sever the relationship with conventional bank parents.
Hmm.
I don't think scholars of course are free to decide as they wish, but I don't think scholars will go too far.
Hmm.
Ultimately, you know, it doesn't serve any real purpose.
Hmm.
Yeah, of course, you still have to go through the KYCs, know your customer processes and things like that. You don't want to be dealing with someone who is essentially a terrorist. And you know, those are principles that are applicable whether it's a bank in the US of A or in Malaysia, regardless. No direct relevance to the compliance of the business from a Sharia perspective. Yeah. Yes.
Even if it's ISIL, like an Islamic
mm-hmm.
terrorist group that's fighting for world Islamic rule. Would you, as an Islamic bank, lend to ISIL fighters?
Our regulators would not permit that.
Right.
Yeah. We would not be permitted to enter into any transaction that contributes to terrorist activities. And I don't know of any jurisdiction that would permit such an arrangement. Yes, please.
You know, it seems to me prima facie that these committees, the Central Bank or Securities Commission, these committees have a lot of power. There's a lot of concentration of power, including the fact that the judiciary also reverts back to them, you know, for a decision. And so, I mean, hopefully if they are non-corrupt, then it's fine. But if they are, then, I mean, where do you complain if these committees themselves are making decisions based on, because, I mean, Malaysia is not a non-corrupt country. You know, so where do you go?
I'm not agreeing or disagreeing with that.
Oh, it was recorded, was it?
Come on, please carry on.
Yeah, so my question is, if you do find that these committees are doing something which they're not supposed to, then where do you go? Where do you complain?
Could you...
because I'm not an expert on Malaysia's you know, system or Islamic banking, but it just seemed to me, prima facie, that they have a lot of powers to decide. And if they have some tie-ups with the banks concerned, you know, who are going to them for a decision, then everything can be, like, really easy-flowing, right? So
you have the courts.
Yeah, and then the courts, they go to the courts, and the courts say, go back to the committee, Central Bank, for a decision. So, I mean, it can be really easy-flowing for somebody who wants a decision to be taken in a particular direction.
I cannot disagree with you, because you have raised a valid point. And this is the same problem the entire world faced with the rating agencies. You know, the bright analysts at Moody's and S&P's gave AAA ratings to piles of garbage. So it's a valid point. These scholars who sit on our committee, the scholars who sit on the committees of other banks, are all paid by the banks. Right? And many, or rather, all the scholars who sit on the Central Bank Committee and most of the scholars who sit on the Securities Commission Committee also sit on, you know, bank committees, because that's where they get their, you know, incomes from. So what guarantee is that is there that these scholars cannot or will not be swayed by what the bankers ask them to do or expect them to do? I don't have an answer. And this question has actually been posed at conferences, not so much in the context of Malaysia, but more to some of these superstar Middle Eastern scholars, those who sit on 70 to 80 Sharia committees. And at more than, you know, 10 conferences, maybe not anymore, some brave soul actually went up to the mic and asked these questions. How can you claim to be independent when you are being paid by the bankers who are trying to secure your approval? And then there was a big debate. So the long answer to your question is, I don't know. But it is an issue. But of course, in Malaysia, the fact that we have that many more scholars hopefully makes it a lot more difficult for this particular problem to arise in any form.
Because I read a paper like this, where it said that the decisions were not made in committees. I mean, I'm not talking in Malaysia, but similar circumstances where decisions were made, you know, on golf courses and dinner parties, because everybody knew each other and what was going on. So it was less about the meeting and more about social networking, which really helped. So.
Yes, please. Yeah.
I think this, like you said, as an industry, Islamic finance has got to carve its own credibility. I mean, if the Sharia scholars are seen to be corrupt, are seen to be making, you know, easy decisions on the golf courses, I think the whole industry is going to sink. So they have to be responsible as an industry. And I think there are also the same issues with other industries as well. Like you say about rating agencies, how can we be sure that they're not corrupt? And some of the decisions that they make would make life and death to some of the organizations, right? But in the end, I think as a new industry, there are initiatives at the international level, and some will be spearheaded by Malaysia to kind of harmonize and provide the governance. Can you comment on that?
Malaysia, of course, tries to take the lead in certain areas, but once you go beyond your own boundaries, it's more about persuasion, less about regulation. So within the country, the authorities can regulate, but beyond the boundaries of Malaysia, it's more about a meeting of minds.
Yeah. I'm talking about initiatives like the IMSB,
mm-hmm.
The IOFI, so those are probably some initiatives to create some kind of international standards and also governance.
Yeah, that is correct. But we also need to understand or examine to what extent the output of organizations like IFSB
mm-hmm.
and IOFI has been internalized by the industry. I don't have the answer to that, but what I know is we still have a long way to go before we can say that the work of organizations like IFSB and IOFI can be said to have been successful.
Can I just jump in to say we're getting close to the end of the time, but I just want to, you've been taking questions as we've gone along and it's been
yes.
really great and lively, but since we don't have as much time left, I just want to turn it over to just open it up to you if there's anything in your planned presentation that you want to make sure you reach before people might have to start leaving, or
yeah.
you can just continue with the
I'm happy to continue. As I said to you as we were walking here, it would be great if no one turned up, but unfortunately all of you turned up. So I'm more than happy to continue the discussion. Because you know what we have on the slides is more data, statistics. Yes, please.
Okay, so I have one contribution to your point. Your point is what Sharia School is doing is actually the same as the auditors, independent auditors like Deloitte, KPMG. So they are paid by the listed companies and they are making audits. And we are still struggling how we will lead them. My question is about your leading the Malaysian Islamic finance. We see that Malaysia is the Islamic finance industry is the biggest in proportion of the world, I mean, with the local.
Yes.
And when I search your countries with a political context, I'm sorry for this question, I don't see that it is about just being in Islamic finance. It is like you with your Chinese power in your country. I think is it true that your government is trying to push the Islamic finance that the Malays have more power in their country? Is that true? Or
I
is
don't,
there an intention
yeah.
like that you are pushing on that way? That's what I see from the outside.
Yeah. Thank you for the question. I have thought about it myself. Initially, my view was the birth of Islamic finance was a result of pent-up demand for Sharia-compliant products. Having said that, I have been thinking about the political angle to this, and it's an area that I hope to, go into. But I don't have an answer, but maybe Professor Saadia, you would like to comment on this. I think you have done a bit more work on this, if you have.
I'm not a political economist. I think Islamic finance came about as a result of demand push. I mean, in the 70s, we had some people who had been educated in the West or somehow got this realization that they would want to have a system that is free from riba. So I think it's demand push. And then the government later saw it as this is an engine of growth. This is a new direction of growth. And true enough, it's catching up, and people want to move into that bandwagon, and it's giving double-digit growth. So, and I don't think it was meant to be something that would empower the Malays, although that could happen also, because this is a chance for the Malays to actually use something that they could be competitive to start with. But I think as it happened, this was embraced not just the Muslims. And in fact, maybe Arshad could verify that some of the banks, or many of the banks, in fact, the majority of the clients are actually non-Muslims.
So in the case of, sorry to interrupt,
yeah.
In the case of Maybank, the bank I work for, 50% of our customers are non-Muslims. 50%. Please carry on.
Yeah, and so, in that sense, I don't know why we have designed over the fact that Chinese and non-Muslims are more affluent, and therefore they probably, in terms of having bank accounts, they would have, you know, more of them would have bank accounts rather than the Malays, especially in the rural. So, and if they see this as something which is a good product, they would take it. And so there is no one thing that was, I think, the right thing that the Islamic bankers did was actually not to position it as just for the Muslims. And so non-Muslims took it as well. So if there is one lesson to be learned by other countries, it's probably that this is a success story, although, I mean, there's still more room to that. In fact, the question was that, how is it that the non-Muslims, the Muslims are not taking it up?
Hmm.
Because you would think that it is a target audience, it is a captive audience. But Muslims have more questions about whether it being truly Islamic, and non-Muslims probably don't have that issue.
Hmm.
No. Interest.
Yeah?
I think the fact that there's no
difference.
Better to get a loan from a Muslim bank because your interest rate's lower. If you're a business person, you can borrow more, and it's funded by oil subsidies, a lot of it, isn't it? Through Brunei.
Well, it depends on
you
which.
Get a lot of money
from depends on which jurisdiction.
So you've got
yeah.
money to lend cheaply.
I don't want to keep anybody.
Yeah.
If someone has to go, please, but please feel free to stay on. Yes.
The other thing that worried me a little bit is the environment, not caring about the businesses' effect on the environment. You said that the banks don't sort of regulate environmental process, tanning or, you know, dumping of acid all over the ground. If it's a profit for the
yeah.
company, they'll still support it. So, I mean, I think that's probably a problem with Western banks as well, and I think if God is looking down on everyone, he'd be a bit jacked off.
No, but what
a lot of you.
That's a valid point. What I said was, at the moment, there are no specific regulations in relation to environmental issues, but at least in the case of Malaysia, the regulators have started looking into it seriously, and in the very near future, I don't know when, they will probably introduce regulations that would require Islamic banks to look at environmental issues.
You see out and investigate.
Investigate, yes. But I know work has started.
Because I've seen huge acid pools in, I think it was Indonesia, because I've been to Australia and flown over, and it lands in Singapore and Kuala Lumpur, the flights. And you can see these massive, definitely dangerous water, big pools of water. And I thought, that has to be looked at. If I was God, I'd be, what's going on there? Because that looks dangerous. It looks illegal and dangerous, and I don't know what was in it.
But in the case of Indonesia, the bulk of the banking industry is still interest-based. Even in Malaysia, only 20 to 25% of the banking portfolio is Sharia compliant. So the majority of the portfolio is interest-based. In Indonesia, I think it's 95-5. They have a long way to go. But these issues are not exclusive to Islamic finance. It's basically an issue that the regulators need to look at. And when they introduce these regulations, it would apply to the industry as a whole, regardless of whether it's a conventional bank or an Islamic bank.
Well, I think I'm going to jump in just to sort of end the formal session here. We've gone a bit over time, but obviously this is a very engaging topic with a lot of relevant questions. So I'll invite you all to continue the discussion sort of after we end here, but please join me in thanking Arshad for an excellent talk today.
And thank you for turning.